Welcome to the Prenda Podcast. I'm Kelly Smith, and I'm looking for the best new ideas in education. I'll be talking to all sorts of people about new types of schools, reinventing education, and helping kids love learning. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome back. We're excited today to be talking to Andrew Collins, the president and CEO of New Learning Ventures. We're here in a conference room in Phoenix, Arizona at a co-working space that Andrew uses, and it's pretty cool. The department, if you're ever in downtown Phoenix, check it out. But Andrew, I'd love to learn a little bit more about you and your background. Andrew has a long and storied and not that long. He's not super old, but he's done already amazing things in education. So tell us a little bit about kind of your journey.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's fun to talk about this stuff. So I grew up in Arizona, one of the few natives here in this state. And, of course, I had to stay in Arizona for college, went down to Tucson, wildcat country, and studied business there. Loved the concept of entrepreneurship. So UVA had an entrepreneurship program that was top ranked and offered me free tuition, so I couldn't say no, right? So I spent a few years down in Tucson doing some entrepreneurship studies as well as economics. But at the end of that, I decided to go into education. So through Teach for America, I ended up teaching for 4 years in South Phoenix at MC Cash Elementary, taught sixth grade. Loved it, learned a lot about some of the issues of generational poverty, but also what brings students into a love of learning and just how do we be creative in the learning process, but also what are the challenges that our education system is facing.
It's amazing.
So that was a really good experience, a very eye-opening experience.
Andrew, stop for just a second, and I think some of the listeners maybe don't know Teach for America. These aren't all I know it's a very famous program in the education circles.
Yeah.
Not everybody knows what it is and how cool it really, you know, operates. So if you can just talk a little bit about the program and how you kind of found your way in that direction.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I kind of think of Teach for America as a, you know, a domestic Peace Corps in the sense that it's taking individuals that had some achievements during their college years, fairly ambitious and could be doing other things, but decide that they want to spend a set number of years. Teach for America asks for 2 years to go and teach in a low-income community somewhere throughout the U.S., and so the commitment there is 2 years. Many, if not a majority of core members is what they call their teachers, end up staying. So I stayed for 4 years. About 70% of core members end up staying in education in some way. And so you now have this huge alumni base of Teach for America teachers that are now doing different things in business and politics, but largely in nonprofit sectors, and many of them still in education, either as teachers or now as administrators, superintendents, affecting change.
How do they find these like superstar overachievers? I mean, you were straight out of school to do this. Did you need an education background? Was there a specific kind of track that led that direction? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think Teach for America is, they haven't perfected it, but done a pretty darn good job of the recruitment process. So they're out on campuses all over the country, building partnerships and relationships and identifying individuals that love kids and believe in kids, believe in the ability of every student to be able to learn regardless of their background. And then from there, they have their methods of, combing through the crowd to figure out who does it. So we had to do a sample lesson as part of our interview, and there's a multi-day.
Did you have to be an education person to do it?
No, most people in Teach for America are not from education, so they put you through pretty intensive boot camp over the summer where we're learning from veteran teachers, but we're also in the classroom.
So it's kind of
getting feedback every day.
Start with super bright people that care about kids, and then say, all right, let's see if we can fill in the gap with some intensive training.
Yeah, and then of course, and then the training continues on. So training goes on throughout the 2 years commitment, and then
pay you more than an average starting teacher salary, right?
No, that's not true.
I've heard that. Okay, no.
No. Teacher of America doesn't pay you at all. Actually, you're just hired like any other teacher.
Oh, really?
Yep. By that school. Placing now in districts and in charters. And so
what are the benefits, though, to somebody? I mean, I know yours were purely altruistic, but if somebody's thinking, I could go be a consultant for BCG and fly around, you know, and interviewing top company executives and solving interesting business problems, or I could go do Teach for America. I mean, what does it bring? I mean, you talked about the alumni network.
Yeah, I mean, our country is, the success of our country rests almost entirely on the ability of our citizenry to participate, right? And to participate in the economy and into democracy. And that is not possible without education. And prosperity is not possible without a massly educated populace.
Right.
And so, I mean, the way that I see it, the best investment that you can into the future of our country is through education, right? And especially when we think about Arizona, right? So my story is in Teach for America, they let you choose, they make you preference where you want to be in the country, right? And there's regions all over the country. And there's some sexy places like New York and D.C. where a lot of people will preference. I personally believe that Phoenix is the best place. But because I was here, I understand the challenges of this, of our state. But I also understand the benefits and the assets we have in this state. And in particular, and this is coming up a lot in the news right now, is the just amazing asset that we have in our immigrant population and multi-generations of families that have, you know, set roots into our state, have chosen to be in Arizona, that are multicultural, that are bilingual, and yet many of them are receiving an insufficient education. And so as that population becomes the majority in Arizona, we're going to be in trouble if we don't invest in it, right? And so...
So pure altruism is what you're telling me. Right?
No, I mean,
which is fine. I think you're awesome.
No, I mean, I think that it's an investment in our state, right? And so it's if you care, I guess that's where it came from. Like, you care about your state.
Yeah.
You care about people.
It's cool.
Then it's the best investment you can make.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think it's amazing. Everybody that I've met, by the way, from Teach for America is this type of caliber of just thinking, really motivated, very driven people, and Andrew's no exception. Well, let's talk about what you did after.
Yeah, so I left the classroom in 2009, went to the Arizona Charter Schools Association. At the time, the association was about 2 years old, but yet charter schools had been around for quite a while. The first charter school opened in 1995. And yet there was no work being done to proactively support the development of new schools. And so just with, you know, background in entrepreneurship and a love for the initiation and development process, and then my experience in education, this opportunity was really attractive to me. And so I came on board the association to lead all of the school development work. And essentially grow some programming in that. So I spent 7 years at the Charter School Association leading school development work from a wide variety of settings across the state. But in particularly, as we progressed in those years, we had a greater focus on the urban core of Phoenix, the population that we were discussing earlier. We launched a subsidiary called New Schools for Phoenix, and our goal there was to incubate 25 excellent schools that prioritize serving students that were underserved, and demonstrating that you can have proof points of excellence. Even when the majority of students are from low-income backgrounds, those students can still achieve at the same levels as their affluent peers.
Wow. And how'd it go?
That's good. I mean, so the schools that we've supported are still fairly young. Many of them are very quickly rising to the top of academic performance, regardless of demographics. You also realize the challenges of this.
Yeah.
And the ability to execute is different than the ability to plan, right? And so, and then also, as we get a deeper understanding of our challenges, it leads us to having to think creatively about solutions, right? And so some of the work we're doing now around innovation, thinking about where are the challenges inherent in the system and inherent in the models that we've employed, and there's opportunities to kind of push the bar further on that. But I'm super proud. I mean, I think starting a charter school is one of the hardest jobs in the world. I mean, you have a highly regulated government-based entity, while at the same time you're opening a nonprofit and you're scaling to multi-million dollars within the first couple of years. And so you're learning to be a CEO as a charter school leader very quickly.
And Andrew's sort of got a laugh in his eyes right now as he's telling this because he knows that I'm trying to start a charter school. So I appreciate that kind of bringing me down to earth. I mean, it's true. You're trying to build a new business, but you're also trying to do it as a nonprofit and a government entity, kind of all three at the same time, and there's lots to figure out. You got to get parents and kids, and you got to build a community. You have to figure out what you're going to teach them, and then find space and hire people and all those things.
Then you got
to
deliver.
Yeah, you have to actually do it. So your goal was 25. You left that in 2016?
Yeah, just over a year ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're still pretty fresh and we'll talk a little bit more about what you're doing. But how far, by the time you were out, I know you hadn't been able to get through the full vision of it, but by the time you left, how many did you get? I mean, is it like one or two, or did you get?
Yeah, well, we started to differentiate our strategy, and I think the strategy, now that I've left, the strategy is probably continuing to evolve, but we quickly realized that it's going to take more than just incubating high quality new schools. Absolutely right. And there's now, I would say, a pretty critical mass of schools that have a unique culture that is focusing on excellence, that is purpose built, meaning the design is coming through their vision and mission in a very intentional way. Right. And those schools have designed based on models that are working around the country. And so now through the program, somewhere between 10 and 15 schools are operating. At the same time, we started to look at schools that are currently operating but needed to improve, and what effort could we put forth from a design perspective and a leadership improvement perspective to help those schools move from a C level of performance up to an A level of performance. And by the way, that's not just charters. There are around 200 schools, charter and district, in the Phoenix Urban Core, and small percentage of them are getting the type of results that we would expect for our own kids. And so there's quite a bit of work continued to be done. And it's, it's an opportunity for schools to really step up and show what's possible. Some of that's through a lot of hard work, but some of it's also going to be through reimagining the experience for students in order to demonstrate what are some better solutions and ones that are going to be sustainable in excellence.
Yeah, so you've seen kind of the start from scratch approach. You've seen at least 10 or 15 of those under this program, but also through charters, your charter association experience. You've also seen, it sounds like, people changing from within. You've kind of seen both models. Can you give people kind of a picture of, maybe an example of each? Like somebody that sort of took a concept and, like you said, purpose-driven. It's like, we're going to intentionally design a culture of excellence. We're going to build it from the ground up. And then maybe a similar experience of somebody trying to change the system, from where they're at.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can talk from a lot of hands-on personal experience with this. Give you a couple of different examples. One of the first ones that comes to mind is a school leader that is just truly demonstrating excellence in a model that is built off of models all around the country. So this is Vista College Prep. School leader there is Julia Meyerson. Just opened second campus this year. 90% plus students qualify for free or reduced lunch, which is an indicator of poverty, yet very quickly becoming one of the highest performing schools in the state. Definitely one of, if not the highest school serving that level of poverty, and very quickly competing against their affluent peers. And so this is a leader that, similar to the way we ran our program in East Coast for Phoenix, spent some time visiting the highest performing schools serving that demographic all around the country, and through very intentional activity, building a really strong leadership team, a really strong governing body, and just very strictly executing on the plan, has delivered a model that's working. It's a college preparatory environment for populations that will be the first in their families ever to go to college.
So where is she?
So they're in South Phoenix, just south of downtown, and then they've opened a second campus in Maryville.
Oh, wow. Okay. So she starts in South Phoenix. She says, here's a population where, maybe there's definitely public schools, district schools there. There's some charters already happening. But she says, I think I can do, and you said college prep, so is this like a high school?
So they're really, you know, college starts in kindergarten, right? It's kindergarten, building through fifth grade, and then launching a middle school is the next step.
Wow. Okay. So these are younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, all right, I'm going to take these kids and convince all these parents, like, send your kids to me.
Yeah.
And then she goes and builds this. I mean, what was it that made that so successful and that's allowed her to get the results that she has?
Well, I think the year one, they started with about 30 kids. So, first of all, it's going a lot of door to door and building relationships with families. And then over time, it's the families that end up recruiting the other families say, hey, this community really cares about our children. And by the way, my child is academically more prepared now than they've ever been.
Right.
And so that word starts to spread, and then there's a demand that's built.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So that's one example. I mean, there's a handful of other examples that I would say are built off of ideas from other campuses, but also starting to pursue some combinations of ideas and starting to even push the bar a little further. One is Western School of Science and Technology in Maryville. Another one is Empower College Prep. So these are two charter schools. And I know, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, there are some districts that are doing some amazing work and pushing the bar and progressive and working on building some 21st century skills in kids, and we can talk about what I'm seeing there as well. The two schools I just mentioned are ones that are saying, like, we really value agency in students, meaning that we know that typically the role of the adult is to provide direct instruction and all the information passes through us.
Right.
And what both of these schools in different ways are starting to think, how do we empower students to take a little bit more ownership over that? So in particular, at Empower College Prep at the high school level is where we're seeing this more. They've implemented a program that's actually based on a school in the Bay Area called Summit Public Schools.
Sure.
Where students are going through a personalized learning path through playlists and as well as building hands-on projects that they're actually showcasing to the public.
Yeah.
Same thing at Western School of Science and Technology. What's something that's really interesting there, they've taken it even a step further. And the students are working on projects that are actually impacting their community. So, for example, there's an elementary school right next to the school whose playground burned down. And the high school students took it upon themselves as a project that they could design and implement a brand new kind of innovative playground, purposely built for their elementary peers. And the students did all the work, designed
these
it.
These are high school
it.
Students.
Yeah, so Western serves 7th through 12th grade now. So it's even younger than high school, right? So this was a couple years ago, so I'm not sure the age of the students at the time. But so let's call it somewhere around 8th or 9th graders.
Yeah.
Designing, building a playground out of their initiative as a school project, but something that where they're applying these core skills into a very meaningful and purposeful project.
It's amazing. So you think about the one, you know, on the one hand, just the wherewithal to be able to plan and design and be like, oh, we could do a little bit of trigonometry or whatever it takes to design a playground. I've never designed a playground before. Yeah. So the willingness to kind of do that. But then even just the ethos of it, right? Like, you want them to see a need and address it. I mean, the world is in a better place because these kids are going to grow up and enter the world. So that's a really cool story. I appreciate sharing that. Well, great. So we've heard some, I think, really wonderful examples of these schools. I realize I kind of cut you off. So we sort of stopped a year ago.
Oh, yeah.
You've been doing interesting things since then. I would say as interesting as ever. So talk about New Learning Ventures. Talk about, you know, what you've been up to since then.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so spending 7 years working with these really passionate educators who see a problem, see a challenge that they're facing in the various communities, and then taking some initiative to start to overcome those challenges through the school design process. And in particular, it was this vehicle of opening a charter school, which allotted them that opportunity to design and launch something new. What we still saw, though, is that the bar of innovation was still low, meaning that the default was still to start with school, kind of the way we think of it, right? Like the 30-to-1 ratio of students to adults. It's a brick and mortar building. You sit in the desk for the most part. There's a singular teacher for those students that is transferring most of the information.
Yeah.
And that it progresses in a linear fashion and started to tweak around the edges. So we talked about some schools that started incorporating project-based learning. Others extended the school day. Others had some innovations in how they recruited teachers, maybe how they paid teachers. But it was still all uniforms. Many of them uniforms, but some not. I mean,
founding fathers. I'm just trying to think of the things that attract people.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it. You say school. What does that mean? That usually means I think of a building. I think of a group of kids that are all the same ages. I think of a teacher up in the front of the room. And granted, there are teachers that are doing some innovative approaches within that setting.
Right.
But for the most part, school looks the same as it has for the last 200 years. And we see that. And what we've seen is that there are schools that are getting better results, but they're marginally better. They're getting 10% better than the average, right? Or 5% better than the average. And we're proud of that, which is something to be proud of. But I think it's limiting. And the opportunity to really push the bar further and see exponential growth in student outcomes is going to take a fundamentally different approach. We also know that there's this challenge that we see as I get more and more involved with the private sector and engaging with employers and entrepreneurs, we start to see that the skill sets that are needed are different as well. We live in an entrepreneurial society, you know, the coffee shop society, much more project-based, freelance worker. There's a report that came out that said about a third of the population today, of workers today, are freelance, kind of contract-based workers that are doing gigs. And that's very quickly going to move to two-thirds of the population. Right. So how are we preparing that fifth grader today for that type of an economy?
Look, for example, the space we're in, right? If we opened this conference room door, we would see people busily at work on computers, many of them, you know, they've got their headsets on, their Apples or whatever. But these people don't have a boss, like, telling them what to do. The way that my kid at school right now in fifth grade has a teacher telling him what to do, right? So you think about that kind of disparity. That's interesting you bring that up.
Yeah, yeah, we see that. And so like that take your own initiative, we call it agency, that agency to be able to make decisions for that day and even fail from it.
Right.
So, I mean,
go figure it out, make some mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, right. That's the life of an entrepreneur, right? Failure after failure. But you learn from those failures and it makes you stronger. It's an iterative process.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Okay, so you see this mismatch. You see that maybe there's some limitations, even in the charter world. And by the way, I've been involved with a couple, not nearly what you have, but I've seen how the charter application process has sort of grown over time, maybe to create maybe less wiggle room. I don't know if that's fair to say, but there's not as much innovation that you can even do inside of that framework. Or you can, but maybe it takes convincing people.
I think the second is probably true. There needs to be some support and some workshops to help people stretch their thinking a little bit. There is you're right in that the process for approval in charters has gotten much stricter.
Well, I'll give an example. So one of the concepts that I feel very strongly about in education is mastery-based learning. So the idea is you don't just learn the first chapter and then after 6 weeks move on to the second chapter with everybody, you know, kind of understanding 60% to 80% to 90%. I mean, even somebody that gets an A, a 91% on the test, still has gaps in their learning, right? So to me, it doesn't make sense to move on to chapter two until you've really understood chapter one. And that those holes compound. I'm preaching to the choir. I'm sure you've heard about all of this, right?
Yeah.
So I go to the charter application and I look and it says, all right, put curriculum samples of what every seventh grader is going to learn in Q1. So the first 3 months of the school year, these are the subjects that we're going to cover, which implicitly, if you think about it, that implies time-based learning. Like, I can't do mastery-based because what I'd love to say is they're going to learn these things eventually, but they're going to learn them as they can, right? As they master, kind of as they master the skills, and different kids I would expect to be going at different paces and things like that.
Yeah.
When I tried to fill out the application, even just the form that I was looking at, like, made it hard for me to communicate that. I felt like I had to almost, I don't know, maybe it's my thinking here that's a problem.
Yeah, no, I think this is a good point. I think this is a pretty common perception. Some of it's true and some of it's, we can push people and they're thinking about it. But there's so much, whether it's laws or policies or regulatory bodies, because of the language that's used and tradition that's used, it seems like we need to fit within a particular box. And some of that is true. However, even in the application that you're describing, there's quite a bit of room for innovation if you think about the purpose for which you're designing something. So, for example, you're designing an instructional process in which you want a student to be able to get to a full level of mastery. Well, by default, we think somebody asked for that. I'm thinking, okay, a lesson plan, and then I need to have a test at the end of it. That's not necessarily true. That's where most people start, and that's probably where a lot of reviewers are looking for. However, if you think about the purpose of that, the purpose is, hey, I want, at the end of the day, we have a goal of someone being able to accomplish a particular skill. It doesn't necessarily have to be done in a day,
right?
As long as we describe it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be done in a written test. So what the charter board asked for is they want to know, how are you? So it's an open-ended question. How are you going to facilitate this learning?
Right.
You get to describe that. How are you going to determine whether or not someone's mastered it? You can describe that, right? So that's where the innovation happens, is you start to think about, well, gosh, you know, what would I want as an employer? Like, how would I have an employee demonstrate their ability in this? And that's where you can get creative in the assessment process and then work backwards from there and getting creative in the learning process.
Right.
How do you facilitate an experience for students? And, you know, maybe you need to take a couple of pages to describe it. Maybe not. There's a lot of opportunities for you to be able to describe different ways of facilitating learning that is still aligned to that particular skill that you're trying to develop in a student.
You're making me feel better, by the way. This is good.
Yeah, and I help you with that process.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. So talk about
I've seen a few of these.
Continue. I'm sorry. I cut you off. So you saw a need for more innovation. Maybe like with it, instead of the wiggling inside of a system, you wanted to see people's minds. And you've given me this example before of you'd hold workshops where you would – it wasn't a function of regulators or laws or anything else. It was just vision, right? The people that are trying to create the school are maybe taking too much for granted. They're saying, here, this is what school has to be because it's always been. And you're trying to – is that what you're trying to say, is that your next phase has been, let's blow that up a little bit. Let's bring in people that maybe are thinking about things outside of that box.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, here's where it comes down to. We believe – so the first thing is New Learning Ventures. What's great about New Learning Ventures is this was founded by a partnership with an individual that is an entrepreneur. It's in the private sector. That's been in Arizona a long time, graduate ASU, and doing great business around the state, and saw a need, and even for his own kids, right? His four boys saw a need for developing a skill set that's going to help his kids and many other kids thrive in today's economy, but also be able to adapt in an economy that's going to continue to change, right? So that's agility in the learning and a love for learning. And so out of that desire came a school. The school was Acton Academy Phoenix, so just started the second year of the school. He was launching this school here in Phoenix, partly for his own boys, but then also for a handful of families in its founding year, built on this idea that students can own the learning process.
Right.
They can guide their own learning. And the role of the adults is to surround them as guides and mentors and coaches and help them learn how to self-govern, but also how to set goals, work within parameters, and learn from, you know, failures at time, but also reflect on how to improve their work ethic, their character traits, and then develop real world skills as well as these core academic skills. So we engage in this conversation like, hey, this is great, but we need to have a bigger impact if we're going to affect the prosperity of our state. And that's where New Learning Ventures started to evolve. We said, how do we create an entity that starts to quarterback and cheerlead this opportunity for innovation across the state? And we believe that there are really talented, innovative educators and some non-traditional educators, namely parents and individuals, running museums or in the tech fields or entrepreneurs, that when given the opportunity and given the resource to do it, and they put their mind to it, will create the best solutions. So kind of a ground-up opportunity to solve our greatest challenges, especially in some of our communities where we know we face significant challenges, coming up with solutions and approaches that are centered around the human, so centered around the population that we want to serve in various communities. So there may be one solution in South Phoenix and a very different solution in Mesa or in Flagstaff or in some of our rural communities. And so, we've come together over the last year, and first, we've learned a lot. We've learned from organizations all over the country that are doing some mission-aligned work. We've also learned a lot from educators of what they need in terms of resources and connecting with other educators that also want to be brave and pioneer some new ideas. And we've also talked with informal educators that start to see the value of connecting all of these resources in the city together to kind of hack a new education. And a lot of that's coming from homeschoolers. And so I think like good homeschooling has figured this out of, we can hack our own education by bringing in some job shadowing, attending museums, bringing in the best of adaptive software online, and then collaborating with other families around some peer-to-peer learning and projects. Right. And then even these, these in-the-mail kits around STEM projects.
Sure.
And then, traveling and just figuring these things out. And we know that that might be solutions for some populations, and other populations may need a different solution.
Right.
So put the power in the hands of the educators to come up with the most innovative ideas that are going to solve our greatest challenges.
It's amazing. Yeah, you guys are doing great work, and I'd love to spend a lot more time on Acton because I think that's a fascinating story in itself, but maybe we'll do a future podcast on that.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I love what you're doing with New Learning Ventures. I think you've mentioned this now, so we talked about kind of the innovations that have happened through charters. You've talked about, you alluded to some work that's being done in the districts that there's innovative people there. And then now as you even start talking about homeschool and totally out of the box, out of the box, things that, maybe your traditional educator wouldn't even look at. I think you're the perfect person to kind of answer the podcast question of the day, which is to talk about, and you've hit on several of these, what are the innovations that are happening in school right now in Arizona? So if you had to kind of synthesize now, think about what you've been talking about, what are the main concepts that people should be aware of? And I think a lot of parents who are probably listening to this they maybe don't even know what's available to them in terms of educational options that are out there.
Yeah, that's great. So we talk about innovation a lot. I've probably used that word, you guys can count, maybe 30 times. The funny thing about that is when we talk about innovation, it actually starts to bring up ideas that have been around for a really long time and perhaps are coming back to the surface.
Yeah.
Or we're moving out of an industrial way of thinking about education and back into one that is more local, that is more Socratic in nature, and more personal. And that's leads me to saying these are some of the trends that we're seeing.
Yeah.
So I'll just go through a list of, I'd say, big trends that are happening.
Yeah.
And I would say these are happening, these have happened for a long time in a classroom level. So you have this amazing teacher that has figured out how to do that, despite the community around them,
right?
Or despite their constraints around them, I should say, but just figured it out, kind of pioneered it in their own classroom. And, by the way, the kids end up loving this teacher more than anyone else.
I had a seventh grade teacher, ELP class, ELP English, that was, she must have read it somewhere in a discussion board, but she came to us one day super excited because she had heard about Socratic discussions. And I still remember this, walking over to the library because they had place for everyone to sit on the ground. And we sat down and we were prepared with, remarks or whatever.
Yeah.
We did a Socratic discussion. And I remember rolling my eyes about it, but that's one of the things I remember from school. I mean, it must have stuck, right? There was something about, and she was able to pull that off, even though that was clearly not in the curriculum.
Yeah.
Never saw it again, right? Never saw it before that. I think it's a great example. There are people out there doing cool things.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the ways of facilitating learning that we're seeing come back to the surface and becoming more broadly utilized is this Socratic discussion. The great thing about that is you're giving agency to the students to have a voice in what's going on in the brain. You're giving them the opportunity to think and think out loud and think peer-to-peer rather than relying on the adult to provide the information. So it definitely helps to develop the critical thinking skills.
And you say old. I mean, this goes back to Socrates.
Well, right. That's what the name is, right?
So, we're talking pretty old.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me run through a few of the other trends.
Fire away.
So one of them is this increasingly personalized environment. So whether it's through adaptive software or other ways to differentiate at a mass level. So right. getting kids to be able to say, I get what I need, when I need it, and how I need it in a very personal way. Now, you start to get that just from a market approach. As you get more schools, they start to specialize. So you have some personalization there, but now we're getting more micro, even right. within the school. Even if I have an arts focus, that's a niche and there's some specialization there. However, within that school, we're getting down to a very personal level. Right. Every student's getting the lesson they need when they need it and can actually repeat that lesson if they need it or go deeper in the lesson according to how they're performing.
Awesome.
That's one big trend. Another big trend is, and it's related to that, is starting to shift the roles of the student and the adult. And we alluded to this around this idea of agency, but saying that the student should drive the learning process.
Yep.
And the role of the adult is to come alongside that student to set some boundaries, but also to act as a facilitator and a guide.
Yeah.
And so there's studies made. If you haven't seen the TED Talk, I just recommend everyone watch it. The Sugata Mitra, this study, right? And so you're shaking your head. You've seen this, right? Many people have. In that just putting a computer terminal in the wall in even the most remote third world countries and the ability of students to be able to self-teach.
Right.
And the pace of learning is incredible too, right? So we see this, and so I'll let you guys watch the TED Talk. I'll link to it. Sugata Mitra, Hole in the Wall School, and what you learn through this study, and certainly it's not in isolation. We see this in other places as well. Is that when you give the students the ability to pursue their curiosity,
right.
Keep it novel, and step back as the adult. And let them go through that process driven by curiosity and driven by a collaboration with their peers who are also curious into this. And even let them fail, but then learn from that failure. I mean, it's like my 10-month daughter, right, who is just going around the house, you know, touching things and playing things and falling. But she learns a lot from that, right? And so now she's, you know, about walking and learning language and all kinds of crazy things every day, none of which I've directly taught her, right? So we have this natural ability to learn. And when we unleash that in the kids and we as adults have the fun role of mentoring and coaching and developing relationships and getting to know them really well and nurturing these things that are intrinsic in them, then amazing things happen. And we start to see some really, really talented gifts and interests emerge out of these students.
And Acton, if I'm right, doesn't call them teachers, right? The adult that's with the kids?
Yeah, at Acton, the adults are guides.
Guides.
And the students are heroes on a hero's journey, and their classmates are fellow travelers on that journey, and they're learning through a variety of quests and adaptive programs that let them have that personalization. And the role of the adult is to love them, guide them, set the parameters, step in only when absolutely necessary, but be able to coach them through that process and helping them understand the relationship between freedom and responsibility.
So you can hear some of the language. I mean, it's a culture, right, that comes across in that. And that's amazing because it's built around some of these concepts.
Yeah.
All right. So personalized.
Yeah, personalized, shifting the agency to the student, which then changes the role of the adult.
Yeah.
Which helps enable all of this is technology. And so we're starting to see really useful ways to incorporate technology. Right. So we don't mean, because we've seen this for a while, we've seen that, you know, replace the paper with a computer, go to the computer lab, you know, once a week, you know, some schools maybe once a day. We're starting to see utilizing the computer as the, in part, the way to actually facilitate the learning.
Yeah.
So we all know you can learn almost anything today. Right? Yeah. So you present a question, like literally, and this was in...
My brakes not too long ago. Thanks, YouTube, you know? anything you want to learn.
Yeah, right? I mean, you could learn musical instruments. You can learn, you know, anything in math, right, through various programs there. But, you know, things that you're interested in addition to these core skills is now available there. And there are some really strong, stronger than ever programs that can literally take you through, you know, pre-emergent to a fifth grade comprehension level in reading through this game-like adaptive software. You can also learn about the Pythagorean theorem. You can learn about dinosaurs. You can explore different countries and learn about the cultures of those countries simply by posing a question to a student. And that says, and at Acton, we pose challenges. And so every session, we have a quest. And these quests are these series of challenges. And so it's amazing when you see a presentation of a challenge. So not just, here's your assignment, do this by the end of the day, but almost like, can you do this or can you not do this? Yeah. Here's a challenge. And when you're faced with this challenge, you now have to figure out how to solve that, and you're fully equipped with the resources to do that. So back to the technology, right? So there are useful ways to incorporate the lessons in these adaptive software, but then also an open-ended kind of seeking exploration through a facilitated guiding of how do you use the internet, right? So it's no longer today's skill set is not just knowing information, but it's actually the skill set that's more important than that is, can I seek relevant information?
Yeah.
Right. So it's like resource gathering. So if I have a problem I'm facing or a challenge I'm facing, do I know how to utilize a wide variety of resources to get the specific information that I need, filter through the false information, and then apply it, and then create something new from that information? That's a skill set that we need to apply every day in our jobs.
Yeah.
And increasingly, as the internet gets cluttered even more, we need to be able to, right, in a variety of settings, we need to be able to filter that information and then apply it.
Fascinating. So thank you. Yeah, this is great. So we've got, I'm just reiterating these so we can remember them. Personalized learning. We got agency. It's my job to learn. And we've got technology to kind of enable and support some of this. Not technology for technology's sake, but if a teacher's in a room with 30 kids, it's impossible to differentiate or to put the agency on them. Really, the only model that can work is you sit there and be quiet, and I'm going to educate you. It's like education is something that I'm going to do to you. You are the passive recipient of your
ed.
And that's just what was possible in the 1800s and the up until we now have computers that have allowed for some of these things and some of these tools. Any other trends that we should know about, or did we hit it?
No, I think there's two more that I'll mention.
Right,
so one is this intentional focus on social emotional skills. And so not that of course there's been great teachers and great schools that have had that focus in the past, and they talk about it as character. And so now it's even more than character. It's character. You have a basis for which you make your decisions. As humans, we have to make decisions every day. And so are you practicing good decision making, and you have a basis for that? But it's more than that. It's getting into the interpersonal skills. And so as we think about what's the future of jobs, we already mentioned a trend towards more project-based jobs, more freelance working, more flex jobs. What we're also seeing is more automation happening. And so the jobs that can be automated will be automated. So what does that leave us? That leaves us with the jobs that are very human in nature, the ones that depend on interpersonal skills. And so me working with you, having empathy with you, knowing how to work, even though we have different backgrounds, but how can we work towards a common purpose?
Right?
And then how do we problem solve? How do we solve problems not only that we're facing outside of our relationship, but also within our relationship, right? So those personality issues come up. And so how do we resolve those in peaceful ways and in productive ways?
Yeah.
So those social emotional skills that are very important, if not more important than, I would say, some of the hard skills that they're developing in math and literacy.
Yeah.
The last one I think we're just finding better ways to do this, is a greater connection to real world projects. So as we have a lot of conversation in the education space around assessment, there's an increase. So first there was this movement towards standardized assessment because we didn't have any good way of indicating whether students were passing or mastering skills or not. And many kids were getting, have a bit left behind, right?
Yeah.
And so let's move towards this, movement of let's assess every student, let's hold teachers accountable for ensuring that every student is mastering skills, at least at a very basic level. Well, of course, we've seen the pendulum shift now into that is really controlling everything that the teacher does and saying, I really am going to be evaluated, paid,
everything,
and our sustainability depends on how the student is performing on this one day.
Which neighborhood we moved into a few years ago was really, it was like greatschools.com, and when I dug into it, it was test scores. I mean, it's like, it's determined every facet of it.
Yeah. And it's all in good merit, and it's you know, it's well-intentioned, and there are some value to it. The challenge is we're losing teachers and we're losing students in the process because they're becoming disengaged and no longer interested in the learning process. And so that shouldn't happen, right? And so some great teachers and more progressive schools are starting to say, yes, we want to build a core skill, and yes, we care about the outcomes that we can very concretely measure in a more standard assessment.
Still take the test. But it's, that's not the main...
But it's, yeah, it's kind of, let's get that out of the way. Let's do that. Let's look at it. Let's see what we learn from it.
Right.
And what are our trends. But at the same time, let's also, as a culture in our school, value the application of those skills and things that are really meaningful, right? So we mentioned a school earlier that was doing projects to solve problems in their community.
Right.
And the value of that is you're teaching students, you're getting them an experience that then they leave with saying, the purpose of an education, the purpose of this whole experience of going through a day with my peers where we're faced with challenges and we're overcoming those challenges and we're building skills and we're building our knowledge, the purpose of all of that is then to contribute into this, you know, a constant solving problems, pushing our community forward, interacting with each other in humane and productive ways. And this just gets down to you know, the basic elements of humanity, where we have to collaboratively live together. We're participating in a democracy, which means that we're learning how to self-govern, and we're learning how to you know, love and respect one another in ways that are going to advance our society and ultimately allow us to, you know, raise families together, you know, have dignity together, be productive together, and evolve in ways that are, you know, advancing us. Not in ways that, you know, are tearing us down or suppressing creative thought.
It's not like a massive game of chess where everyone has to win. You know, you're somehow got to compete against each other. It's like, let's collaborate. Let's do what humans do best, which is like, let's use our human ingenuity and solve problems together. And you know, this sounds corny, but make the world a better place. Can we say that?
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're always going to have competition, but it's... you know, it's productive competition, and it's a way that how do we compete with each other?
Right.
How do we continue to push and challenge each other to learn more through that competition? But at the same time, what built every great society is collaboration. How do we collaborate with each other as well in order to advance both of us? How do we think win-win?
Well, Andrew, these are huge. Thank you so much for sharing everything that you're seeing in the education world. And I've had a great time just learning from you about, you know, charter schools and education innovation. Good luck with everything you're doing. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, man, same to you. This has been fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Prenda Podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or innovating in education. And if you want to follow my progress designing a new model for school, you can learn more at school.prenda.co.